I'm Ken MacLeod. From the day we launched unfetteredmind.org, it has operated without a paywall, advertising, or a subscription charge. This is only possible through the generosity of people like you. If you find our materials useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind: How to Practice Right View and Intention.
And one of the other characteristics of this period is that there's a love of reason, because reason seemed to offer a way of transcending the messy world of emotions. And we find that same idea that was present in the early Greeks is also present in this period of Buddhism, where the spiritual path was felt to be a path through philosophy, through logic, etc., etc. This is what we get in late medieval Buddhism in India. And Tibet inherited this. So when I was exposed to the Eightfold Path, you had the Four Noble Truths, and then you had four different levels of understanding for each of the Four Noble Truths, which made 16 in all. And all of these different qualifications of the Eightfold Path, right view, well, these were the things that constituted right view and right intention, and these were the things that constituted right intention and right speech and right action. And just lists and lists went on and on and on. This was so highly developed. And it's absolutely impossible to practice. It's so elaborate. There's so many do's and don'ts. You end up frozen. You can't do anything. And as I looked at this again and again, I came to the conclusion, and I've learned this from a number of different sources, that what is presented as the Eightfold Path, what constitutes right view, what constitutes right intention, are descriptions of the results of when you really practice them. They're what you evolve to, or what you end up at. And one of the problems in practice that I've encountered over and over again in teaching is that people try to use the results as the method of practice. And just to give you a very simple example of that, which several of you have heard me talk about before, if you say to somebody, relax, what's the first thing they do? They tense up. Because relaxation is the result of a certain effort. If, on the other hand, you say to somebody, take a deep breath, now let it out slowly. I'll do that again. And do it once more for good luck. How do you feel? Well, more relaxed. And many, many of the instructions for meditation, or what are presented as instructions for meditation and instructions for practice, are actually descriptions of the result. And yet we tend to interpret them as prescriptions for action. And that just gets us into a big mess. So what I want to do this evening is to talk about the first four of the first four parts of the Eightfold Path, and talk about them, making this distinction between the result and what you actually do, and see if we can get clear on that. And I'm sure we'll have time for questions after this. So, The usual claim is that in order to practice a path, you have to understand it. And then practice consists of doing the right things and avoiding the wrong things. There are several problems with this approach. The first is, it's childish. This is how we train children. What tends to happen is that adults who take this approach to practice end up being infantilized. And I have a very vivid experience of this when I was at a retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh. We were divided up into groups for discussion, and we were given a talking stick. And the first woman who talked was an elderly psychotherapist. This was a retreat for mental health professionals. And she said, "I don't know what's going on here, but I feel like a child all the time." And this stress of having this structure and things like that. I'm having stress headaches that I haven't had for 20 years. I don't understand this. But it's exactly what I'm talking about here, is like, oh, there's a right way to act and a wrong way to act. And somewhere or other you're going to get punished, or you're not going to fit in if you act the wrong way, and so forth. It's very childish. It's very much based on the reward-punishment of which earlier and more simpler religions are based on. It's also ineffective, because when we try to practice that way, we model our behavior on somebody else. And there's always an element of artificiality. Problem, Steve? Okay. There's always an element of artificiality about that. Okay? And can you hear Anne?
Yes, so okay.
And we, our behavior is never really natural, because it hasn't evolved out of us. We're emulating something outside us. And it's also untrue, because understanding something and then trying to do it is only one way of learning. There are other ways of learning and developing skills, and it may not be your way. So the point here is for us to try to find our way, the way that is appropriate for us. I have a student who now teaches in Colorado Springs, and all perspectives, she does things that couldn't possibly produce any results. She makes things up on the spot. She just responds to what's in front of her. She doesn't plan particularly ahead. She doesn't itemize things in nice categories or lists or anything like that. There's nothing to understand. And yet she produces absolutely great results with the people that work with her. So we need to find, each of us needs to find a way of practice that is appropriate. And I hope some of the ideas that I present to you this evening may open some doors for you. The other thing is that so much of Buddhism is presented in terms, and this is very much in keeping with this emphasis on the rational, that if we just understood why it is beneficial, then we'd make the rational decision to do it that way. And this theory is that we're basically rational beings and make rational choices, underlies most economics, most sociology, a good bit of political theory. And you can see what a mess that's got us into in the last couple of years. Because we aren't rational people. We don't make decisions rationally. Emotions rule all the way down the line. That's even being corroborated now by neurological studies. So trying to approach practice from a rational perspective, it, in my opinion, is just hopeless. It doesn't work very well. The key in Buddhism is this quality we call attention. And one way of thinking about attention is that it's the ability to direct energy. I mean, there's energy in our system and it's going all over the place usually. And when we sit and rest in the experience of breathing, we're actually encouraging the energy to move in certain ways. And we experience that as attention. And attention is not a conceptual thing. It's an emotional energy. And so forming a relationship with attention allows us to develop a very, very different relationship with our emotions. And that is key to this. So what how I regard the Noble Eightfold Path is a description of the areas of life in which we are encouraged to bring attention. And by bringing attention into those areas of life, they start to change. And they change in ways which, when we read accounts of the Eightfold, of say Right View, then it'll be like that. Let's take a look at Right View, because it's the first one. Now, view here is nothing fancy. It's just how we look at the world. And Right View is usually described as having faith in the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, accepting karma as a working principle, accepting the four truths, and not seeing things in terms of matter or mind at those extreme positions. But if we try to actually do that, I mean, how do we do that? It's very, very difficult. What I want to suggest is an alternative. How do you look at the world right now, for instance? Could we have the mic up here, Steve? Art, if you're not connected with a thing, you can bring it right up here, and maybe that would be helpful. Or put it in front of the speaker.
I did put it in front of the speaker, and it just wasn't.
It wasn't working. Okay.
It's a dim-dim.
It's dim-dim. Okay, I'll take it up with dim-dim then. Okay, so just put it down there, Steve, for anybody. When you're using the mic, just hold it straight in front of you, please. Sitting right now, how do you view the world? Anybody? Just right here, right now. What's happening? How do you view the world? How do you view yourselves? Well, do any of you view yourselves as something that exists in its own right? Hands up. Come on. Basically, all of you are doing that. Don't give me this, you know. That's how we ordinarily view ourselves. But if we bring attention into that, we see that it doesn't really hold. How many of you have experienced a situation today where you had mixed feelings about something? Oh, good. A bit more response there. Now, if you're a single entity, how can you have mixed feelings? You either feel this way or that. And I run into this all the time with people. Some people say to me, well, I feel this way about that. I feel happy about this. But then I feel, no, then I'm not so happy about it. And, you know, part of me is really, they don't say part of me, I'm really sad, but and I'm angry. And they get all confused because they view themselves as a single entity, and yet they have all of these different feelings. And one of the things we get from a technique that's been developed recently called focusing, is to change the vocabulary slightly to, instead of saying I, say part of me. Say part of me feels this and part of me feels that. Then there's no problem having all of those different feelings, because all of the, if we shift from looking at ourselves not as one thing, but as being composed of many parts, then things become very simple. Oh, I can have all of these different feelings and even more. And now you don't struggle with them the same way. Now, this business about karma, a lot of people say that it involves belief. Well, I don't think it does. For me, karma is simply a way of saying it's that what we say and do and think, or everything that we say and do and think, has actual consequences in our lives. What we say and do and think sets in motion processes in us that affect how we experience the world. So, if I'm angry all the time, and I harbor anger, and I tell myself that I'm angry, then I will inevitably come to see the world in terms of opposition. And that's going to affect how people relate to me and how I relate to others. And if I feel needy, then I will inevitably experience the world as not supplying what I need. And I'll be motivated to take shortcuts or even to steal to get what I need. That's going to affect how people regard me and how I experience the world. And these tend to become self-reinforcing patterns. On the other side, if I give generously, if I give things to people, then people like to be around me. And so I'll have lots of companions and we'll all have a good time together. If I make a point of speaking gently, then I won't be offensive to people. And again, people will respond to me a certain way. And it's just describing how our action, the way we think, the way we talk, the way we act, shapes our experience of life. And there's really nothing more to it than that. Business about faith and the three jewels. Well, it's helpful here to have a proper understanding of the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Buddha is the emptiness of our, or Buddha, let me not bring in too much Buddhist vocabulary right now, but Buddha points to the fact that we can't say what we are, that when we look at what we are, it's completely open. Needs a bit more gain on the speaker. Can you hear now, Anne? Is that better?
Hello.
Okay. Can you boost it a little bit? Yeah, it's right in front.
Oh.
Yeah. Is that good enough now?
That's much better.
Yeah. Can you hold it there, Steve? Okay. Buddha refers to this open, ineffable, indescribable quality of experience. Dharma refers to the clarity and vividness with which experience arises. And Sangha refers to the fact that experience arises without any restriction. Now, that's just how things are for us. So not to have faith in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha would, in a sense, be to contradict the fact that we experience things. It doesn't make any sense. So what I'm trying to point out here is that when in the course of our lives, check in, bring attention to, how am I looking at things right now? For instance, when somebody, when we find ourselves opposing or in conflict with somebody, ask ourselves, how am I looking at that person? And if it's our partner or our child, at the moment that we're in conflict, we're probably not looking at them as they actually are. We're viewing them differently. We're viewing them in terms of our, what's being projected by our own emotions. In other words, we've fallen into, quotation marks, wrong view. And so just by the simple act of bringing attention to how we're looking at things in each moment, we'll find that the way that we're looking at the world begins to change. And it changes into the various qualities that I've described. We don't get that way by trying to look at the world that way. We get that way by paying attention to or bringing attention into how we are looking at the world in each moment, how we are looking at ourselves. Does this make sense to you? Okay. Let's move on to intention. Intention is usually described as renouncing what produces suffering or struggle in our lives. And this is very much based, or finds its origin, in the way Buddhism originally developed, which was as a way of people to practice who lived in monastic communities or who lived as hermits. And they were leaving aside the complexities of life, living very simply, and just leaving all that stuff behind. Now, for most of us, it isn't so easy. That way of life has its challenges, definitely, but you're reducing input very significantly. And thus, and by intending to simplify one's life, then you live with less struggle. But that's not how it is for us. We live in this very complex world with many, many different demands. So I think the more way, a more appropriate way for us to practice is bring attention to whatever intention is operating in each moment. Now, when we do that, things get uncomfortable very quickly. Because we see that most of the time we are acting out of one reactive emotion or another. And we're not really acting with any intention. We are just reacting. And we live in a very interesting age where the whole economy is based on eliciting reactions in people. You know, if you go into a supermarket, or if you go into drugstores these days, you go into Walgreens or CVS or any of these things, how are the aisles situated? How have they placed the aisles? Well, they're at an angle to the door. Have you noticed that? They aren't straight up and down anymore. They're at an angle. And they're all different angles in there. Some are placed this way, some are placed this way, some are placed this way. And you go into these stores and you immediately get very confused and disoriented. And it is absolutely intentional. Why? Because when you're confused and disoriented, you're much more prone to just react, and you'll buy things on impulse. That's why they've set these stores up. And you also notice that if you go into a supermarket, things are arranged so that if you need to bake a cake, you've got to go to almost every part of the store. You can't get all of the ingredients in one place. And design is to get you wandering up and down the aisles where they have music to distract you again, putting you in a somnambulant state so that you will just react and buy things. And advertising is very, very much designed to elicit certain reactions. And you know whether you fit the profile or not by whether you connect with the ad or not, because if you don't connect with the ad, it's not intended for you. And everything is geared to eliciting reactions so that you buy stuff. Now, there's only one problem with this. We become inured over time to stimuli. And so the advertising or the marketing efforts have to become steadily stronger to draw our attention. And so our reactions will become stronger over time. And there's no way that this is sustainable over a long period of time. It basically leads to the disintegration of society because the economy is actively reinforcing reactive emotions. Very interesting system that has evolved, but I don't think it's going to work in the long run. Now, when we start bringing our attention to our intention in each moment that we live, very interesting things are going to happen. Several years ago, I had two people who came to me because they had built up sizable debt and they wanted to get out of debt using mindfulness. Okay. Well, I'm not a debt counselor, but it's not rocket science either. The first thing you do is you start tracking expenses, tracking everything that you buy. That's the very first thing you do if you want to get out of debt. And one person just started to do that right away, and the other person, it took them about 4 months of constant encouragement and reinforcement and me threatening to quit until they started tracking. In other words, they just started bringing attention to the action of shopping. And as soon as they did, their shopping patterns changed. Because they started to get in touch with the intention that was operating. And they would go, oh, I don't really need this right now. And just tracking the what they were expending stuff on started, say, reduced the amount of their expending to the point that they were pretty well breaking even. That wasn't getting them out of debt, but it was stopping them getting further into debt, which is good. We'll get to those efforts later. Now, the next effort was to push that intention even further. Or that attention further, so that they started to look at what were their priorities in their life, as evidenced by what they were buying. And when they started to look at that again, their patterns changed, and they thought there's whole areas that they didn't need to spend money on anymore. And that moved them to the point of being able to generate a surplus and hence moving out of debt. And both of them successfully moved out of debt, completely out of debt, in about a year and a half, 2 years. Then they had a real problem. They suddenly had much more money and they didn't know what to do with it. But that's another story. Now, when we bring attention to our intention, then we often discover that there are multiple things going on in any one instant. It's not just this or just this. We want to do this for this reason, we want to do that for that reason. All of these things are going on. And trying to figure out what the right intention is in all of that is impossible. Rather, and here we work with a principle that I call inclusive attention rather than exclusive attention. By including all of those different intentions, and just in the same way that I was talking about the respective you, all of these different parts, but opening to that experience, so applying inclusive attention to all of those different intentions, a strange thing happens. They begin to sort themselves out. And something emerges, and we know which direction to take. So you can see from what I'm describing, I'm not describing a process by which we're going to think things out analytically or rationally and figure out what the right thing to do is. We're bringing different kinds of attention, different qualities of attention to intention. And in that process, shifts take place. And we're able to, we start acting in a different way. We start acting or intending things which are more in keeping, in balance with ourselves and our environment. They're realistic, they aren't over the top, they're respectful of everything in concern. And that's in the direction of right intention. So I've covered these two somewhat. Let's pause here for any questions you might have before we tackle the other two.
What you were saying about having conflicting emotions and a part of you feeling one way or a part of you feeling another way, what I find in my situation is that those parts of me kind of occur in a serial fashion. In the sense that I'll feel one way about the subject and kind of feel that's really the way I feel about it. But then later on I'll completely change and that other part will sort of take over. And it's it can be difficult sometimes when you're trying to make a decision.
Well, as with all good questions, the answer to it lies right in the question. What you're the way I understand what you just said is that there's a process that plays out in you. And you've seen this enough to recognize there is a consistent process. So what I recommend is don't make a decision until the process is played out. You know, I'm going to feel about this way, and now I'm going to feel about it at a later stage about this way, and things like that. And there's, in many cases, there isn't a lot you can do to speed up that process. It's something that often has to play out. So if circumstances allow it, allow that process to play out, because basically, it's all reaction. And making a decision on the basis of reaction is usually problematic. When that process is played out, then it may be possible to look at the situation and say, oh.
How do you know when it's a reaction?
I think it's sometimes very difficult to tell. But one of the qualities, there are a couple of qualities. One is stickiness. You know, it isn't quite clean. It's like you put it and it's a little sticky. And this is not a rational way. I'm describing a quality to it. Another way is insistence. Insistence. It has to be this way. It has to do it. Whenever the internal vocabulary is has to, must to, always, never, very, very good chance that there's a reactive pattern operating. Well, it just has to be this way. I mean, one person that I was reading recently said, belief is where we stop thinking. This is actually a pretty good indication of reaction. When you stop thinking and it just has to be that way, then you're in reaction because you've closed down, it's fixed. So insistence, fixedness, stickiness, these are the qualities I use to recognize reactions. Does that help at all?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Stickiness.
You can connect with that one, can you? Okay. Other questions?
About the many intentions going on, I'm trying to understand your last point. I get the part about all these different intentions moving in us at mm-hmm. the same time. And the last part you talked about, I'm trying to think of the words you use, but somehow the right intention can arise
yes.
out of that. And I'm just trying to work out. It just reminds me of like sitting practice when there's all these different feelings happening at the same time, and somehow it just starts shifting. The whole experience starts to shift. So,
yes, but what's very interesting here is you're trying to understand it, right?
Well, I think I feel like it's linking to experience, but I just haven't quite got it.
Well, fair enough. Just do it.
Okay.
I mean, what are the chances you'll run into a situation about which you feel conflicted tomorrow?
Certain.
Okay, 100%. All right. So when that happens, don't try to figure out what the right thing to do is. Just open to everything that you're experiencing being pulled in this direction, in this direction, this direction, this direction. Now, most people don't want to do that because they don't want to experience being pulled in different directions. They're very attached to this idea of being one thing, and so they feel being pulled apart. But if you take the view that they're all of these different parts, then it's much easier. And another reason people don't want to do that is because when you do that, you actually feel things more deeply. And most people don't want to feel things deeply. They just want to skate along on the surface of life, and that's just fine.
Yeah, it feels like you're using this word intention in a totally different way than it's commonly used. Because it's funny, when I hear the word intention, I think of this business about goals. And I know I've heard you talk about the problem of goal orientation in
yeah.
spiritual practice.
Well, I said earlier, attention can be thought of as the ability to direct energy. That has to be understood in a very open way. It's not narrow. Or that's one way, but it's not just that way. Intention can be thought of as the ability to direct attention. You see? And again, we are, partly because of the medieval heritage, our own medieval heritage, when there was all this philosophy going on, most of it which was a complete waste of time, and very much because we are still in the aftermath of the age of reason, you know, and the age of enlightenment, in which people finally came to the conclusion, yes, reason trumps emotions. And so this ended up with things like logical positivism and things like that, and which has collapsed under it, you know, because it doesn't work. Reason never trumps emotion. Emotion always trumps reason. Everything that we think is the result of emotions, not because of supposedly pure reason or rational process, which this is a basic mistake that goes back right to Plato and Aristotle. And if we stop trying to be reasonable people and relate to the fact that we're highly emotional that's probably going to work a lot better.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.